From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Manoush Zomorodi is going to help us get better at spacing out. She's the host of a podcast called Note to Self, where she talks about the effect of gadgets on our lives. A few years ago, she did this experiment with listeners to figure out what would happen if people put down their phones and just embraced boredom for a while. She's not suggesting we get rid of our devices, just figure out how to keep them from running our lives. Join us in just a moment.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join The Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As you'll hear in a moment, when Manoush Zomorodi came up with this project for the listeners of her podcast, she wasn't sure what kind of reaction she'd get. She wanted to know if people changed their relationship with their gadgets, their phones, would that make them more aware or more creative? So she developed this week-long series of challenges to help listeners detach, you know, put down their phones. And more than 20,000 signed up, way more than she thought, which told her there are a lot of us who are thinking about this. Zomorodi says we're at a crossroads in the human condition where we're inundated by technology as never before, and it's still up in the air whether it's going to enlighten us or swamp us. It's probably both. Today in the program, she's joining us to discuss what she's learned about our relationship with our devices. She has a new book called Bored and Brilliant. Her radio show and podcast is called Note to Self. She's the host and managing editor. And we began our conversation with the story that really got her thinking about all of this. When her colicky newborn baby demanded to be walked and walked.
Yeah, and I felt really guilty about it, too, because as a new mother, you are told that this is it. This is the moment you've been waiting for as a woman, as a procreator, and that this should be the happiest time of your life. Yeah. And when, for those of you listening who have had colicky babies or, you know, sick babies, that's even worse, my goodness. Mm. But colicky babies have there's a tedium to it that is just mind-numbing, and you don't believe that they will ever grow out of it. And so it really did feel like and of course, sleep deprivation, we now know that it just is extremely debilitating. Yeah. So combine the sleep deprivation with the walking and the crying, and you have a person who all she wants is peace and quiet, and therefore, like, that's why it was like 10 to 15 miles a day, because that's when he would sleep.
Yeah.
And my mind could be a little more bored, which at first I thought was awful.
But then you say in the book that you describe it as this shift happened where you started to get into this. I think you say it's a rhythm you got into.
Mm, it really was. And it was, so this is, I should say, 2007.
Yeah.
My big joke is that my son and the iPhone were born 3 weeks apart.
Right.
But I was not an early adopter, so I did not have a smartphone. And I couldn't stop walking because then he would wake up. So there was no talking on my little flip phone. And anyway, like, who else could talk for that long? Who had the time? So it was just the walking. And as any distance runner knows, it's the first couple miles that are the toughest, right? But then you sort of mile 2, 3, 4, you click over into sort of I would say a meditative state, but it's not meditation that was happening here. It was the mind wandering that sort of clicked in, where and that was, in retrospect, so vitally important. And as someone who had been such a type A, career-driven person, it had been years since I'd really just thought like that for hours and hours and hours.
You know, one of the things that's, I think, cool about the story as you tell it in the book is you say you came to be fully in tune with your baby, like you came into this kind of symbiosis with your baby. Say something about that.
Yeah, I it's funny. He is turning 11 this year. Wow. And so I watch to see the – it really is when you first have a kid, a baby is an extension of your own body. Like the minute – but I think in my case, I was hyper-attuned because this was a baby who was very sensitive, as colicky babies often are. So like I knew where every crack in the sidewalk was and I knew what his reaction would be to those cracks. Or if someone sneezed, like I knew which decibel of sneeze would wake him up and which would be okay. There is this sort of, it's almost an externalization of yourself in some ways. I mean, now I can wax poetic and say in some ways he sort of symbolized all my own sensitivities. And now, of course, he's grown into and is his own person. Yeah. But at the time, that's what's happening when you have a newborn, I think. And for some of us, it comes as a big surprise. I had not spent a ton of time with newborns and certainly in retrospect, wish that I had done more to prepare for those moments. But I think it was almost a little bit terrifying to me that when you, the externalization of your own and the, just this little thing that you want to make as comfortable and you're so worried about all the time. I think, you know, in retrospect, again, I think I also had some postpartum anxiety. Yeah. But, you know, actually from difficult times come creative moments. Yeah. So,
well, that's the idea, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
right,
so this is pretty early in the story, though, as you say in the book. I mean, you started to get aware of this boredom and what it was doing to you, but this was before you started to think about writing about it or even apply the lessons.
Oh yeah, way before.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, no. But what I learned later was I think I was starting to figure out, like, how did I get to this moment?
Yeah.
What's my story? And I later learned that that's called self-referential processing. Of course, there's a word for it. But that's the idea of crafting a coherent sense of self, of figuring out what your own personal story is, how you got to this very moment. And then, of course, deciding, like, well, how's the rest of the story going to go? Setting longer-term goals for yourself and then trying to figure out how you're going to get to them. And for me, that was a determination not to return to shift work in the newsroom. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But for me, it was like, okay, if I'm going to be away from this kid, how am I going to make sure that not only can I help pay the bills in our household, but also that I feel as though I am moving forward as a woman, as a journalist, that I feel like I am learning going forward.
Wait, so that insight came from basically being bored?
Yeah.
So, okay, so the next part of the story comes in, I think it was 2013, and you get your dream job. You become host of Note to Self. But then comes the point when you say you hit this wall. I think crashed is actually the word you used to describe it. So what's going on in 2013?
Yeah, so this is the next sort of key moment is the show is doing fine. It's 2013. I think it was before Serial had come out. But podcasting was in the ascendant.
Yeah.
And, of course, I wanted to, in my type A fashion, kill it. You know? What was I going to do that was going to get people as jazzed about the stuff that I was reporting about when they were listening? And so I think so many of us have read one too many Fast Company articles where you're like, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to brainstorm. I'm going to write down the first 20 ideas that come to me.
Yeah.
But no one tells you what to do when nothing comes to you.
Right.
Like nothing. That is what happened to me. And it wasn't – I've had writer's block before. It was not like that. You're like, I can't figure out how to say it or got to wait for the muse. This was like sand was in my brain, Doug. I don't know how else really to describe it. It was a nothingness that I found profoundly disturbing. And now I know it was very lucky that I was as disturbed as I was by that, because it jolted me and it made me think, well, wait a minute. I've had good ideas in the past. Okay, so calm down. When were the times that you had good ideas in the past?
Yeah.
And I started to recount, and it was waiting in line for coffee and just sort of looking off into the distance.
So you're tracing backward. Like, when was I a deep thinker?
Yeah, when was I? And it was pushing that damn stroller also is what I realized. Yeah. Like I started to realize it was the times when I was bored. Mm. And then, of course, I was like, so when am I bored now? Oh, never. I'm never bored because, of course, the single greatest thing that has changed us culturally, some would say, is the smartphone. And I did get a smartphone in 2009 and realized that for it had been several years, actually, that I had been bored because now any time I had a spare moment or felt that moment, you know, where you're like, oh, I'm bored.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to be. Yep. You have your phone. You can check the headlines and the weather and respond to your husband and ask him to pick something up on the way to work. And, oh, did your mom get back to you? What's up? Oh, and then social media, of course, had just come about, too. And as someone who devours information, this was both the most wonderful thing and the most potentially brain-destroying thing possible.
You don't like the idea that the show and the book, Bored and Brilliant, is seen as a detox. You don't really like that. Explain why you don't like that.
Detox to me says flushing out. And I just think the problem is you can give up cigarettes and you can give up alcohol, but you can't give up food. And there are different kinds of food. Some of them are more nourishing than others, but you need them for calories to give you energy and also sometimes just because it tastes good, and that's fine too. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think of time with my phone similarly, it's not on or off. I don't think that a binary is helpful to people. Look, once in a while, if you have the, you know, awesome, go into the woods, set up your tent, don't look at your phone for a couple days, that's amazing. But so many of us, really, how are we going to get through everyday life? It's not by turning it off all the time, because our phones are great. They connect us to people. They connect us to more information than we've ever had access to. So we want the good stuff. It's just how do we mitigate the other stuff? And so to me, this is about self-regulation and starting to understand some of the effects by virtue of the design, by virtue of the tech itself, by virtue of the business models around a lot of the technology that we use every day, especially the apps and platforms, when we can understand what effects those things have on our behavior and our neurological capacity, then we can start to understand why we act certain ways and then maybe make changes that get us more of the good stuff from our phones.
Because this stuff is not going away. Right. You say that, and this may be a saving grace, that humans crave reflective time, but we also seek balance. Say a little bit about that. What do you mean there? Because it seems like there's something in human nature that selects for sanity and reflection as well as the other part. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It makes complete sense. I think it myself when it comes to reading, right? Journalism, taking in the news, right? We know that we want to be informed. We want to be good citizens. We want to be up on the headlines. We want to have our own opinion. And so we read and we read and we read and we post and we like and we favorite and all the rest of it. But there does come that moment where you stop processing all the information that you have taken in, that you are simply retweeting without even reading what you're retweeting. We know that most people don't read the things that they repost. And also what I learned was that we start to suffer from – this is why we're so tired at the end of the day. Yeah. So as one researcher told me, that they know that the more tired you are, the more likely you are to be checking Facebook at the end of the day. Wow. And that is simply – but, you know, checking Facebook, it's that moment when you're sitting there at the end of the day, and maybe back in Mad Men era you would have a scotch on the rocks, but now you're scrolling Instagram and not even really like looking what you're scrolling, just kind of doing it because it's like eating some candy. So back to the reflective part. So it's that moment that I want people to catch where they're And I know it for myself that when I am scrolling mindlessly, that means I'm tired. Yeah. And that is my body telling me that it is craving the reflective time and that I've taken in too much that day. And what I really need to do is go for a long walk and think about the stuff that I read all day long. I used to have a post-it note on my computer that said, think, underlined numerous times, about what you read. Because I had definitely fallen into the habit of stuffing as many shows and articles and posts and podcasts into my brain without actually synthesizing them. It's information overload is real.
I had this constant discussion with my wife about, like, she likes to read the New York Times paper, the paper itself, on a Sunday morning. Like, go through the whole thing, takes hours. I'm like, well, what's the difference? If I'm sitting here with my laptop reading the online version, what's the difference? And something you write about in the book is that there is a difference, kind of a big deal difference.
You and I, like, I had the exact same question. I was like, is there a difference? And so I went to try and understand what is the difference on reading on a screen versus reading on paper. And it turns out, there's not a ton of research on this, but there is some research that says reading on paper, you actually retain the information better, in part because your body is taking in lots of information, not just the words, but where they are on the page, what the page feels like, maybe what it smells like. And you're actually able to go back and locate something, or you're able to retell the plot of a story much more easily if you have read it on paper as opposed to on a screen. I think we all agree that, you know, if you're going to be reading on a screen at night, a Kindle is a good choice because it doesn't have the blue light. That's sort of accepted. But I also think now, in terms of, like, being productive with your reading it on paper, you might just hold on to the information better too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing that I have heard a lot more professors and teachers insisting from their students is that they do not take notes on a laptop. And that is also supported by research, which says that if you are typing, you're more likely to just be transcribing verbatim what is happening in the class, as opposed to when you write on paper. Not only are you getting more haptic feedback, which helps you synthesize what you're learning, you're also more likely to be jotting notes, where your brain's, you're not writing word for word what the teacher is saying, you're shortening it, you're condensing it into language, and then that therefore solidifies it in your brain in some way. So I love that there are all these little things that we can do, and they might require being a little retro, but it just is, in the end, makes us more productive because it makes us smarter.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that we read differently. I mean, you write about how the methodology is different, that it used to be pretty with the written page, it's very linear. With a screen, it's different, and our brains haven't yet adapted to figure it out. I'm not sure when we will, but we haven't yet, apparently.
No. Yeah, it's interesting. The Marianne Wolfe, I think you might be thinking of, she's at Tufts University, and she studies how we read, essentially. And yeah, she sort of talks about this idea that, you know, if you get used to jumping around on, you're looking at Twitter, or you're skimming the web, or you're doing whatever you're doing, and she said this herself, when you sit down to read a book, you might find it difficult. And she told me a story where she said she sat down to read her favorite book of all time, Hermann Hesse, The Glass Bead, and she just couldn't read the darn book.
Yeah.
And she, again, these moments of profound distraught and disturbance, like, what is going on with me? And so she wanted to understand what the heck was going on in her brain. And it's like any muscle. If you don't use the slow reading muscle, it begins to atrophy. And so she found that it really took her 2 weeks of every night sitting down with the book, getting through as many pages as she could to get back to the place where she could sit and read a thick piece of literature for an hour on paper. And she was happier for it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but you, at least in the early days, you didn't give your kids ebooks. You wanted them to experience reading with paper first, I guess.
Yeah, I got to say that I love looking at the copies of the various Harry Potter books strewn around our house.
Yeah.
They are so, like, they're just about falling apart. And you can almost take a guess how many times they've been read by, like, how far off the cover is from coming off the body of the book.
Right.
And my kid knows exactly, like, he's a voracious reader. And so he will grab it off the shelf and he'll go right to a specific page to start reading again. You can't do that on a screen. I mean, that's not to say that if we don't go on a vacation, I don't want to pack all the bags. I won't occasionally give him my Kindle. But for now, books are such a pleasure and they love them so much. I mean, they're going to be having to look at a screen for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
So why not let them live in this fantasy of delicious paperbacks for a little while longer?
Yeah. Let's talk about boredom more. I love that you wrote a little bit about the history of boredom. Is it true that Dickens was the first to use the word boredom?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yes.
I know. So, yeah, it's Dickens is the first that we know that where it actually appeared in writing. So 1853, mm-hmm. Bleak House. And I think so many of us think like, oh, well, that makes total sense. It's the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Machines are starting to take over. Humans don't have to work as hard. Maybe they have free time. Maybe they actually have time to get bored. But actually, if you think about it, just because they weren't using the word bored doesn't mean that people weren't referring to some of the various emotions that are equated with that human state. So I think of like Kierkegaard, who preferred the word idle,
yeah.
or Heidegger, who thought it was necessary to sort of make meaning in our lives, thought of it more as an existential thing. And I think semantics are extremely powerful because the way that we think of boredom now, of course, is as something awful to
yeah.
be avoided
yeah.
at all costs. Only boring people get bored,
yeah.
Doug, right?
Right. One of your friends said that it was like Ebola.
yeah.
It's something right. bad that we need to treat. As opposed to just embracing boredom.
Yeah, that's actually Maria Popova
of
the Brain Pickings.
Yeah,
and she's so wonderful. And she's written beautifully about how various philosophers throughout the ages have discussed the concept of boredom but used very different words. And so now, like to me, if we can start to think of boredom as, okay, maybe it's uncomfortable at first, but we now know so much more about how our brains work and the neuroscience of what happens when we get bored and trip into mind wandering.
Yeah.
And mind wandering is where the magic is.
This interested me because this idea of boredom being empty or a reflection of alienation, that's what comes with boredom, how that can be an important prelude, you write, to deeper understanding and maybe even a prelude to creativity. In other words, we have to go through that difficult part, that tedium, in order to get to the good stuff almost.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, okay, when you bored, right, it can be on like a long car ride, but also some of these philosophers have referred to boredom sort of more as an existential or spiritual crisis.
Yeah.
I think it helps to explain sort of what we now know is happening in the brain. So, Doug, we are in an amazing moment when it comes to fMRIs and understanding how the brain, some of its circuitry is working. Of course, there's a lot more to know.
Yeah.
But they do know that when you are not doing something that requires your focused attention. So let's say you're folding the laundry, going for a long walk and pushing a stroller for hours and hours, whatever, something repetitive that doesn't require your focused attention, or you're just lying on the floor staring at the ceiling. When you do that, your brain trips into something called the default mode. And the default mode is also referred to by scientists as the imagination network. And so what happens in the default mode is you actually do your most original thinking. You take two disparate ideas and smash them together to create a new idea. And you also do something called autobiographical planning, yeah. which is that looking back at your life, taking stock of the highs and lows, building a personal narrative, a coherent sense of self, and then looking forward and figuring out where you're going to go from here. So really deciding what your life is all about, it's really important stuff. And of course, if you're tapping your phone, you can't tap yeah. that important brain yeah. function.
What's the difference between daydreaming and doing tasks that require more attention? There's this researcher, Jonathan Smallwood, you write about
yes.
in the book. Mm. He studies mind-wandering, basically. And he says that these two states are different sides of the same coin. You know, doing something that requires attention and daydreaming. How are they different?
Well, you're okay. So they're different in that when you're focused on doing something, you're coordinating your body, right?
Yeah.
But you are making something, whether that is making dinner or making your Metro card go through the slot or whatever. That's right. what you're doing. Or you're writing something. You're making a sentence.
Yeah.
And if you think of mind wandering, is you are making ideas. And I would say Dr. Smallwood, lovely Scottish brain scientist that he is very, very clear. He says, you know, that there can be not good mind wandering.
Yeah.
Because I was like, it's great. You get bored and then your mind begins to wander and you daydream and this wonderful things happen. And he's like, well, careful there because yeah. other things happen too. There are different kinds of mind wandering. So there is poor attention control. You just distracted. There's guilty dysphoric mind wandering. This is where you ruminate, where I say to myself tomorrow, oh, I wish I'd told Doug. I'm such an idiot. I should have told Doug about that other thing in the book and blah, 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 blah. But then what I really have been leaning into is this idea of positive constructive mind wandering. And that to me is if you can encourage yourself to go towards the positive, constructive mind wandering, that is where you can potentially see results. As we discovered when we did the Bored and Brilliant exercises with our listeners that the book is based on.
Yeah. Let's talk about that project. So this starts in 2015, and this was this yeah. week-long series of challenges for listeners. And I mean, you got a ton of what was it, 20,000 people respond?
It was super weird because I said – so after I go through my little personal epiphany and I'm like, well, God, I wonder if I get off my phone more, I'll get more bored and then I'll be creative. That seems very strange, but I don't know. Maybe my listeners would be interested. So I asked them. I was like, would you guys be interested in maybe messing with your digital habits and just seeing what happens? Because I don't know. No one really knows what – like there's not a ton of research on how we use our phones and what effect they've had on our brains. And I thought like a couple hundred people, Doug, would sign up.
Yeah.
And 20,000 signed up
yeah.
in the first 48 hours. And I was like, oh, okay. This is not just me.
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Yeah. And so you asked these questions to – I guess to kind of establish a baseline early on.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about that. So explain what you found. I mean, what were the trends or the characteristics that you found that people were thinking about or worried about just as you were setting this up?
Yeah. So it was really interesting when we asked people, you know, why do you want to do this? Why did you sign up? And the key things they said, it was the top three things were that they said that they were worried that their digital habits were messing with their productivity.
Mm-hmm.
They were concerned that they were addicted. That was the word that they used. And they were also worried that their digital habits were affecting their physical health.
Yeah.
So their sleep, among other things. Those seem like pretty fundamental things that you would want to fix. And so, yeah, we wanted to establish a baseline because I think what I was concerned about was that people would be like, well, you know, people told you they feel better, but how do you really know?
Right.
So
right.
I was like, okay, we're living in an era of self, sort of the ability to measure everything we do, self-quantifying, and why not why not see if we can create some data? Because people love data, right?
Yeah.
So we partnered with apps that helped people measure how many, not only how many minutes a day they were on their phone, but also how many times a day they just checked their phone. They just, you know, the quick pickup that you do, like, oh, did I get a new email? Oh, what's the weather? So we started with a baseline that people were spending on average 2 hours a day on their phone and doing about 60 pickups a day.
Right.
And I should point out that those numbers seem extremely low just 3 years later. Right now we know that the average American spends 11 hours in front of a screen every single day. And I also think, you know, my audience is – they feel that this is a problem. So obviously they're kind of a little bit on it more than other people.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, and also it was the average. So for, and we had cross generations. So somebody who's 75 might not be, you know, be on Snapchat all day long. And so that for them, checking their phone 30 times a day might be a lot. Whereas an 18-year-old who is, lives on the gram, then, you know, maybe the 150 times a day would be how many times they were checking their phone.
So they said they thought they might be addicted.
Yes.
Are they?
Oh, well,
that's a tough one,
depends,
right?
Who you talk to, Doug. Yeah, that word addiction is extremely loaded.
Yeah.
However, it's, you know, there, it is starting to be seen that clinically, it is starting to be classified as an addiction. I recently had Dr. Guy Winch. He's a well-known family psychologist who says not only is it addictive, it's extremely, very, absolutely, yes, addictive. So there, that's what some people say. And other people say, like, that, you know, addiction is, we can't go there yet. We don't know that for sure. It hasn't been proven. I use the word with quotation marks around it, but the more I learn and the more scientists seem to learn, the more I think it's going to be pretty accepted to be using it all the time.
Well, doesn't it just matter that they think they're addicted? I mean, that says something.
Yeah,
itself.
I would argue that.
Yeah,
sure.
Me too. Yeah.
Definitely. And I think that's part of the big issue with all of this is, so, you know, we are conducting a vast experiment on ourselves every day when we use our technology and these tools. Nobody, there's no control group. Nobody knows what the long-term effects are.
Yeah.
And for a while, I think we trusted Silicon Valley's utopian message that the technology is good. It is improves us as individuals, as our society, makes us more efficient. It can good for capitalism, all of those things. And it's really, you know, and that I would say is the profound difference between doing that project in 2015 and this moment now in 2018, where the bloom is off the rose and we are talking about fake news and depression and anxiety that many young people are feeling the more they spend time on some of these platforms. We're talking about bots. We are talking about how do we pay for good journalism. The reckoning it's showing up now.
Things are moving so quickly. What are you learning about the things that you put in the book and the way you're talking about it now, just in terms of the pace of all of this?
Mm.
Is it changing yet?
Yeah. I mean, I think that our little weirdo experiment in 2015, in the year and a half or 2 years that it took me to write the book, to go out, get more interviews, do more research, by the time the book came out in 2017, at the end of 2017 – this concept has gone mainstream. You know, I took my kids to the pediatrician, and this was the first time that she asked, do you brush your teeth? Do you wear a seatbelt? Do you look at a screen 1 hour before bed?
Wow.
So we're starting to think of technology in every sort of way that we interact. And when I went on the book tour in the fall, it was so interesting to see who came out, and it was very clear. It was parents who are struggling with screen time with their kids. It was managers who are worried about that their employees are burning out because of all the constant pinging. The real work is not getting done because everybody's slacking each other all the time. And the third was young people who are really, whether it's a clinical diagnosis or not, feeling anxiety, depression, and FOMO, fear of missing out, really the mental health side of their tech use. Those were the three sort of key groups that came out to sort of discuss, like, and maybe these are people who are more sensitive to it, but I think that we're more and more people are feeling that. I remember I had one young woman who, she came with her mom, and she was I think she was 14 or 15, and she said, I love this idea of boredom. I don't think I've ever experienced that before, first of all. And second of all, I don't know if I can do this because I'm really, really scared. I don't like being alone. I don't like having my thoughts to myself. And that to me was a very profound moment because if you, you know, and I said to her, I was like, well, listen, you and yourself are going to be together for a very long time. So you need to learn how to talk to each other to find out what you need. You know, if you can't have the conversation that says, no, I am not going to post a picture of myself at this party, or I'm not going to respond because I'm really angry at my friend right now via text. It's that little moment, that split second before you act, that you have to check in with yourself to make sure you're doing it for the right reason. It's intention, right? So if there is a group of young people who cannot, and older people for that matter, who can't do that, that's very worrying. And I would also say the other wonderful thing that happens when your brain trips into the default mode, as we've talked about, is empathy. So imagining what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, literally imagining, that requires creative thinking. And so how can we have empathy for people who maybe didn't vote the same way that we voted, or people who need more support from the government? Or how can we really start to understand each other as Americans during a time that we definitely need some empathy? Well, if we're not in the default mode very often, maybe part of the problem is that we're just reacting too much online.
Manoush Zomorodi is the host and managing editor of the podcast Note to Self. Her new book is called Bored and Brilliant: How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Manoush Zomorodi. We're talking about her new book, Bored and Brilliant: How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. So people like being given a project. They like a workbook, right? They like an
they
assignment.
Do, yeah.
So you offer these challenges in the book. And I wanted to go through a few of these. And let's start with number one, which I think is great. Observe yourself. So what is this? This is about like taking a kind of inventory of the way we deal with
and
digital stuff.
And you can do that either by downloading one of the apps to measure you if you feel like, you know, because I thought I could observe myself, but I didn't realize, Doug, that I was checking my phone 90 times a day.
Wow.
I thought I had estimated 30 times a day. So very often some of these things have become reflexes and you don't even know it. But then I started to realize, oh, yeah, the minute I get into an elevator, I check my phone. The minute I get out of an elevator, I check my phone.
Yeah.
What the heck could have happened in the 0.7 seconds in between? Nothing. But I think it's become sort of a reflex. So you can either, if you trust yourself, you can observe your habits, or you can use an app to help you, you know, sort of just get a number.
But the idea is to be aware, right? Just aware
totally.
Of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
It's funny because as I'm getting ready for this show, I kept going over to my phone. I'm like, this is exactly what she's talking about. I have no idea why I'm going over there, but I did. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry about that, Doug.
Yeah. Okay. Challenge two. Keep your devices out of reach while you're in motion. explain this, and I think this was really interesting, like no walking and texting, for example. Keep your phone out of sight. Talk a little bit about what happens, for example, when you walk and when you text. Like, what's going on?
Well, you are running the risk of getting run over. Seriously, you are.
Yeah.
You're
Seriously,
annoying the people behind you. Yeah. But also, you are just not present in the world to observe what is happening around you. And I think the physical reflex that we have developed is what we're trying to break there. So when we asked people, you know, how would you describe your relationship with your gadgets? A lot of them responded that it was like a pacifier or a binky or their lovey or like a worry bead. So like you say, like, you know, it's become that thing when you feel a little uncomfortable. You know, you're rather than looking like the loner while you're waiting to pick up your kids at the playground, you look at your phone just because, not because you're really looking for anything, just because it makes you, it soothes you in some way. And so no wonder we want to hold on to it like blankie. It's soothing. So by getting it off our bodies, we can start to be more aware of what is going on in us, because then we just, you know, we add a little, you have to go look for it before you do it. Or like me, I began to think that my phone was vibrating when really it was my stomach that was growling. And so to me, that was the perfect symbol of this disconnect that many of us are having with our bodies because of our gadgets. Like that, you know, why do you have a headache? Oh, maybe it's because you've been looking at your screen, or why do you have a backache? You know, tech neck is real.
Yeah.
So the physical relationship that we have with our gadgets.
There's a Dr. Alex Soojung Kim Pong at Stanford. Mm. You talked to him. We talked to him last year, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
He's great. He talks about rest. And he talked to you about distractions. And one of the things he talked about was that distraction is a choice.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I totally agree with that. I feel like, well, you know what? I take that back. I do agree with that. But I think for many of us who don't think we can not be up to date on the news or not constantly checking our texts or have our phone out of sight, these are the rules, right? This is how society has gone, and your loved ones expect you to be available. So does your boss. So that's and when it's not your boss texting you, it's the New York Times or something else texting you, right? All these notifications. So I think Alex's whole thing is like, you know, set yourself up for not being distracted. But I would also say, like, look, a lot of this stuff has been designed. I don't think it's all our fault.
Yeah.
It has been designed to distract you. That is what it wants to do. And so it's like I always think of Snapchat as such an interesting example where have you ever heard of streaks, Doug?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what streaks are? Okay. So for those who don't know, it's not getting naked. It's when people exchange selfies every single day on a Snapchat, and you don't want to break the streak.
No, you can't break the streak, or you get punished for breaking the streak.
You get punished for breaking the streak. Yeah. Right. If you keep exchanging selfies, then you get points and trophy emojis or whatever. But if you break the streak, the real life repercussions have also been that for some, particularly high school kids, if you break the streak, that means that your friendship is over, that someone has crossed you or something awful has happened. And so when you think about the way that our, again, to quote Tristan, the way that our attention has been hijacked by the design of some of these things, I don't think we are entirely in control. It's built that way.
Yeah. Another one of the challenges is to try to get through a day without taking a photo. And I was really interested in this. There's this phenomenon called the photo-taking impairment effect. Talk a little bit about this. This was so interesting because it's, I guess, when we're taking a photo, like you go into a museum of all, this seems crazy to me, but I know it happens. Or even people who go on vacation and can't, they're not actually looking at the thing. They're just taking the photo of the thing. And I think you've described it as outsourcing the experience in some way.
Yeah. This is another, this was another thing that I sort of was thinking might be happening to me, but then was confirmed by a researcher.
Yeah.
This is at Fairfield College in Connecticut, and she did research where she took people for a tour of a museum and let people take all the photos they wanted and then tried to – and then tested them, you know, like, what did you see? And then they – she took another group, and they were only allowed – I think they didn't take any photos. And what did they see? And essentially, you know, we've all done this where, oh, my God, look how beautiful that sunset is. And then you're so busy checking the filter and taking the photo and making sure you got the shot that you don't actually stand there and look at the darn sunset. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But she also found something very positive, which is that if you use your photo taking ability, if you actually really compose the shot, specifically if you use the macro function, like you zoom in on a little detail, that you will remember. You will remember the detail because your brain had to make a decision. Mm. I see it this way. Oh, but what if I went in this way? You know, you actually have to process it in some way. So, you know, I love this idea of using our tools to enhance our memory. There were people who were like, wait a minute, I use my phone to remember where I parked the car.
Yeah.
And I'm like, absolutely, go for it. If that is working for you, great. But then I had other people who were like, you know what? It was the first snowfall and I decided I wasn't going to take a million pictures of my kids outside. I was just going to go sledding with them and enjoy myself. So it's those, it's deciding when is it working for you? When is it giving you what you want? As a technological tool, as opposed to dictating to you what you should be doing at that moment, which really isn't actually suiting your needs.
Yeah. So you established this baseline, right, before you started Bored and Brilliant, the project. And then after it, you get the numbers back. And it's interesting your reaction to it because like, because the average decrease, for example, in phone use was only 6 fewer minutes.
I know.
And only one
bummed.
Less pickup of the phone. Yeah, you were bummed. I mean, it, because I have to say, that does
bummed.
Not seem like a whole lot.
That's what I thought, too. And I, yeah. So I went back to all the researchers who'd been advising me, the neuroscientists, the cognitive psychologists. And I was like, ugh, we barely did. And we barely moved the numbers.
Yeah.
And they just laughed at me, Doug. They were like, first of all, you tried to change people's extremely ingrained behaviors in one single week.
Yeah.
The fact that you changed the numbers at all or even got people to give you numbers and think about this is an achievement. And second of all, you, what are you talking about? Like, the stories matter. And of course, here we are in this data age and I'm like, the data doesn't show, you know? And they're like, no, no. What did people tell you? Yeah. And what people told me were things like, I feel like I'm waking up from a mental hibernation after this week of challenges, or I'm actually picking up my guitar again, or I'm sleeping better, or I did better at school this week. Those are real things. And who knows? Maybe the reason the numbers didn't go down is because they started to use their technology more as a tool as opposed to as a distracting device. I don't know the answer, but and I thought, well, maybe those effects won't last too long. But it was interesting. So that was I when the book was coming out, I reached out to some of the original group of people who did the Bored and Brilliant Challenge. I was like, do you guys remember this kooky thing we did in 2015? And not only did they remember, but profound changes were made and they stuck. Like one guy who we had another thing where we asked people to take an app off their phone that was driving them crazy just for the day. He took off all his social media apps and he never put them back on his phone because he loved the way that his daily life felt better. Or another woman in Wisconsin who renamed her farm Make Time Farm and then every Sunday was inviting people to get Bored and Brilliant on her farm every month. So like just because the data didn't show, you know, a really go down to 2 pickups a day doesn't mean that there wasn't a profound change, which that made me feel better.
It seems like the stories are the takeaway. the way people reacted, the way they interacted with you, the way we talk amongst ourselves about all of this. Because it says, you say in the book that Bored and Brilliant is this chance to, as you put it, force the issue. Like, and that seems to be an important point, that whether or not we're going to get a hold of all of this, at least we're becoming aware of it and we're talking about it.
Yeah, I think that's part of the issue, is like there's no name for this crossover between technology and, I guess, I don't know, wellness is maybe one way to talk about it, or society or the cultural. I don't know. There's no word for it yet. But what I have found as I've been traveling the country is that this is extremely important to people and they are thinking about it all the time. And so it's interesting. I hear from a lot of teachers and professors who use the book in their classrooms. And why? Because there's no curriculum around a lot of this. So they've used the book to write their own curriculums. And what they say is that it's great because it gives a structure to the idea of digital literacy. It helps talk about what is good citizenship, how does your brain work. It's all, really an interdisciplinary understanding of, I hear it from religion teachers who teach it. I also hear from tech teachers who teach it, that this covers a lot of ground. And by having this little book, at least it gives them some sort of format to follow. And they can do it as a group with their students, which makes it a lot easier, because if you're all not taking photos one day, that's a heck of a lot easier than just one lone kid who's is the weirdo, right? If I'm helping a single teacher in America, then that's a win for me.
Manoush Zomorodi, she's the host and managing editor of the podcast Note to Self. Her new book is called Bored and Brilliant: How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.